Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Are you ready for this?
Cameraman,
but
what the hell is that? Midway across the Hudson River was a perfectly circular disc.
For
the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that the like
suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to edition 430 of Strange Days Indeed. It's the first podcast-only version of this program, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This week, a special edition of Strange Days Indeed, as we look at the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights and the phenomena that went on around Phoenix, Arizona for many, many, many hours. And it wasn't just flares. But we'll get into that with Mike Fortson, who was a first-time witness when he saw an amazing chevron-shaped object in the sky on March 13th, 1997. Also, with Phoenix Lights documentary maker and DVD producer Dr. Lynn Katai. We'll probably talk about it with Alfred Lemberg, too. And as usual tonight, with his weekly editorial, Dave Furlott will join us. These are Strange Days Indeed. On Saturday, March 3rd, Chris Rolfe of UFO Monitors East Kent in England sent my email list UFO updates, which I heartily recommend you go and read, an intriguing post about a couple of U.S. Air Force F-15s having a UFO encounter over the U.K. in January of this year. Chris also told readers that audio of the encounter is available. So now having the technology to be able to call on the phone and record, I immediately picked it up, the phone that is, rolled digital audio and asked Chris what had happened. Here is some of that conversation.
I think all credit should go to a photojournalist by the name of Kevin Patterson, who writes a column called Military Matters for a radio magazine called Radio User, which was formerly known as Shortwave Magazine. They also publish another magazine called Practical Wireless. So if any of your listeners are radio amateurs or are interested in shortwave listening and that, they will know those magazines very well. He was contacted by some military monitors who obviously monitor the military aircraft sort of communications using equipment called scanners. And that's how he came up with the story.
Can you give us a backgrounder on what happened between the F-15s and the object?
Well, from what we can gather, there was a flight of F-15s out of RAF Lakenheath on routine patrol, which they do most days. They were called up by London Air Traffic Military and were asked to intercept an unidentified target that they'd been monitoring on radar, which was at an altitude of 3,000 to 4,000 feet. The F-15s used the call sign Gator. They proceeded towards the area, which we don't know where this is at the moment. We suspect it may have been in the Norfolk area, but we're not 100% sure yet because another incident occurred that same day, which was unusual. in the fact that some aircraft enthusiasts spotted an aircraft very high up doing some very unusual manoeuvres. So whether there's any connection there or not, we don't know. Anyway, the F-15s proceeded to the area. They got solid lock-ons on their radars of this mystery object, and they actually made visual contact with it. And they described it as being coloured black. One of the pilots said it sort of looks like a rock. I suppose that's the best way he could describe it. But they had two visual sightings of it, one at 17,000 feet, and the second pass they made was at 17,700 feet. So whatever this thing was, it was gaining altitude. And as one of the pilots said to London Air Traffic, this thing is not falling. You can actually hear them state that it's definitely not a bird, and it's definitely not an aircraft. You quite clearly hear one pilot say to another pilot, did you see that? And the reply was, yes, but I'm not going to talk about it.
Oh, my. However, fortunately, as you say, the guys listening on the scanners, listening to military frequencies, heard that and have recorded it. So can we listen to that file, Chris?
Yes, no problem.
Hi, dude. No kidding. I just flew over on bullseye 008 for 20. I had a radar hit, and I was swinging it with, like, 30 knots. There was something there. It looked like it didn't look like a bird. It looked like, no kidding, a rock to me. I have no idea what it was, but basically, just heads up, try to stay away from 17,000, keep your nugget on, so I have no idea what it was. I'm going to use my radar to see if I can pick this object up again. I picked it up twice. The first time I picked it up, my radar broke lock, so I thought it was just some kind of bad lock or potential chaff. I'm going to turn back towards the north just a little bit.
Fuel pickup trail.
I've got it again. This is 17.7. 3 miles off my nose. It's 17.7. I'm flying that way now. I'm going to slow down. I'm not going to get below 300 knots. But back towards you. Dude, I can't tell. Some small, very small black object. I had it at 17.7. It just flew right over me.
From the object appears stationary.
Well, I could tell because it was... This movement was slow. I think it's really about 30.
You're 80 knots.
Yeah, my radar showed between 30 and 60, so I have no idea what it's actually doing. But it went from 17 the first time I saw it to 17.7, so it's not falling. I don't think it was a bird.
Better locking it with auto guns.
What's that?
Are you taking a manual lock or is it an auto gun lock?
I'm getting with auto guns every time. Dude, I have no idea what that is.
But it just passed over me.
I've got it at 17,000 feet, 8 miles off my nose, bullseye 049 for 20. 17,000, I'm going to get down to 16.5. It's 2.5 miles off my nose right now, 17,000 feet. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to slow down as much as you are. Maybe you can slow down just a little bit more and get a better look.
Copy, confirm you've merged with it.
I am about to merge right now. I'm seeing him. Whatever hit me now. And I'm going to get my airspeed back before I maneuver. Are you locked or clean?
I'm no joy approaching line abreast with you. 2,000 feet high, 18.5.
Cover that. I'm in an easy right hand turn. You said you're at 18.
Yeah, I climbed back up to 19.5 now. You're 6 o'clock for about 3 miles.
Cover that. I have visual now. I'm going to fly underneath you.
Copy. I saw it that time. I could not make out what it was.
You did see it?
Hey, firm.
I don't want to circle back around. Well, hopefully we'll be able to see it through the HUD.
I think got somebody else out here with us.
Yeah, I see him. Hey, did you see anything?
Negative.
Fascinating stuff, Chris Rolfe. Do you think it's the real thing?
It sounds like the real thing. I mean, one can never be too sure, but then why would someone go to all that trouble? I mean, I know people have done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
They've actually quoted the frequencies that London Air Traffic was using to contact the aircraft, and we know it was an air-to-air frequency that the two pilots, or the pilots, were using to talk to each other. I don't know how many aircraft were actually in the flight, and this is obviously something that we can look into more when we make our approaches with the Freedom of Information Act application.
What is it, access to information in the UK?
No, it's the Freedom of Information Act here in the UK as well. But ours is slightly different to the ones in the States. But because it involves American aircraft, representations have also got to be made under the American Information Act. And this is where we need help of anyone in America that can assist in making inquiries.
Well, I'm sure that some of the listeners to this program, and you could actually send an email to the list, to the UFO updates list, asking for assistance.
Do you want me to give that email address out?
Yes, sure.
Yep, it's UFOMEC, UFOMEK, at hotmail.co.uk.
That's UFOMEK at hotmail.co.uk. And I will put that link in the program listings so that when people are hearing this, that if they're not sure what we just said, they can go check. And UFOMEC, of course, is UFO Monitors East Kent.
If we hear any more on this F-15 business, we will, of course, let you know.
Thank you, Chris Rolfe. And look forward to hearing from you again really soon.
Thank you very much indeed.
These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlock.
Anyone who knows me or has listened to me speaking about UFOs knows all too well my position on the exopolitical theory concerning UFOs. However, for those who might be wondering or unfamiliar with my position, let me spell it out for you. We, the inhabitants of this tiny planet called Earth, are not the be-all, end-all of the universe. Now, according to those that buy into the exopolitical theories of Dr. Michael Sala et al., our planet must be the one jewel in the entire universe that everybody and their dog is trying to get control of, or otherwise trying to snuggle up to. This has to be the case because, according to the Exopolitics group, there are some 57 different races of alien beings that are either working with or against or observing every little thing that happens on this planet. Oh, and here's the good part. Our military and government hierarchies are working with some of the aliens. Matter of fact, if you believe in exopolitics, you would have to believe that there's a war going on out there with good and bad aliens, and the objective is, wait for it, Earth. Any of this sound familiar? It does to me. Think X-Files, SG-1, and my very favorite, Men in Black. Now, I could be wrong. This planet may very well be the single most valuable planet in the whole wide universe, but I doubt it. I kind of believe that we would have to be outrageously vain to think that we are that kind of prize. Much the same as I think we would have to be equally outrageously vain to think that we're the only planet in the universe with intelligent life. But the exopolitical movement goes on, and with people like Dr. Stephen Greer and Dr. Michael Sala continuing to fuel this political theory, it gains more and more attention as time goes on. Basically, because the whole theory sounds like a great story. And, in fact, it is. Just look at the popularity of television shows like SG-1, The X-Files, and movies like Men in Black and X-Files the Movies. Those shows and movies made billions of dollars over the years, and rightly so. They're great stories. However, the people who wrote those shows knew they were writing fiction. Science fiction, to be exact. The exopolitical movement, though, keeps adding to the story by bringing in things like the book The Day After Roswell, written by Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso. And that muddies the water even more. According to the late Lieutenant Colonel, most of our technology that has been developed since the 50s has been based on alien technology back-engineered by companies from pieces of a salvaged flying saucer Lieutenant Colonel Corso gave them. Now, just so everyone is on the same page, I did a little digging, and I was able to trace the pedigree of most of that technology that Lieutenant Colonel Corso claimed he was responsible for, and it had nothing to do with any alien technology, simply sweat and human ingenuity. But the new thing to come out of exopolitics now is that our governments and some elite corporations have been privy to secrets that we gained from alien technology, that basically it would allow us to have free energy, end world hunger, and make our planet a better place to live. But these evil governments and corporations are hiding these things from us because if they release them, they'd lose money and, would have to own up that there are alien beings that they've been working with. Really? Yeah. On at least one occasion, it has been stated that the events of 9/11 were a direct result of the government and these corporations hiding these things from you and me. I find that incredibly tactless. Unfortunately, the Honorable Paul Hellyer was given a copy of Lieutenant Colonel Corso's book to read and has been embraced by the exopolitics crowd. They've shown him only the things which would support their viewpoint, and unfortunately, on May 9th, he may be saying some things that are going to make most ufologists cringe, because the gist of what he will be saying has no proof, and in some instances has been shown to be, at the very least, suspect. I've just about had it with exopolitics and the crazy, wild stories they keep spouting. Matter of fact, I'm calling them out on the mat. If anyone associated with exopolitics can show any proof positive that there are 57 alien races, and proof positive that any of these races are working with any government agency anywhere, and I don't care if it's the animal control people, prove it to me, and I will publicly apologize to anyone involved with exopolitics, any place, any time they want it. Disclosure about what our governments know about UFOs and extraterrestrial life is a valiant goal, but the exopolitical movement is not going to be the group that accomplishes it. In fact, they may very well be the catalyst that keeps us from the truth. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Good one, Dave. Yeah, I think you summed it up quite succinctly for me and you and many, many people in the UFO field.
It's just that it's we have such an interesting capability to look at a lot of the different things that are happening with UFOs in all around us, you know, old stories, new stories, the whole thing. It's all there. Look at that. Let's enough with these stupid theories about working with this government and bad aliens and good aliens. I had enough with it.
Yeah, we could actually start our own movement in the UFO field and accuse governments of all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you know, as long as we don't have to prove it, we're okay.
Well, we also need to prove that UFOs exist as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have so much evidence, okay, and that's the only thing that we can call it, is evidence. We have the images, we have the videos, we have the testimony from people. It's real. It's not something that's going to go away. It's been with us for a long, long time. We don't really have to prove that so much. It's just that we have to basically show it to the people and let's find out what the government, because they've got to know. They've got to know. They've been scrambling jets. They've been doing all kinds of things. And they have been shown to be lying about things. Why?
Exactly. Why is the question. And perhaps one day, fingers, eyes, ears, nose, and toes crossed, we shall find out.
For sure.
For sure. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again next week. Bye, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Beware of the blob. It creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door, all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch. Be careful of the blob.
Last fall, we offered part one. This is the second part on the devil and his angels, Matthew 25:41, and the global invasion that's coming in Revelation 12:7-12 on the subject of extraterrestrials. You need it.
ETs are the rage of the age. Major colleges and universities are offering courses. You need to know your enemy. Presently, millions of ETs are under the control of a being who is cunning, fearsome, perverted, and enemy number one. He and his destructive forces take delight in causing tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, and blizzards, falsely called acts of God. Though they dwell among the stars, they make millions of trips to planet Earth daily, traveling faster than the speed of light. They attempt to depress, possess, and oppress their victims. Soon a Star Wars battle will be fought among the planets, and the headquarters of these spirits will be transferred to the Earth. Who and what are these ETs? Who created them and why? Can their existence be proven? Can their attacks be repelled? Get the answers to these and many more riveting questions by ordering the amazing new video by Dr. Jack and Rex Elevanepi, Extraterrestrials, Global Invasion Approaching. Call or write today.
Our guest in this segment of Strange Days Indeed is Mike Fortson. He was a resident down there in the Phoenix, Arizona area back on March 13th, 10 years ago, when there were several sightings of very strange things in the sky above and around Phoenix, Arizona. Mike Fortson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Earl.
Usually I start by asking a lot of our guests, how on earth did you get involved with UFOs?
Well, I was closing a bedroom window, and there it was. And I ran outside and yelled at my wife, get out here right now. And we looked, and we made it to the edge of the patio, and there was a large, what I call a chevron or a boomerang-shaped object that at arm's length was over 30 inches long coming at us. And it pretty much grabbed me at that point.
Ah, and that was your first experience?
Very first. Never even dreamed of anything like this.
Now, this was a chevron, and what date was it when you saw it?
March 13th, 1997, 8:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time.
Boy, that information sticks there. So
you can't help it. It's almost like your wedding date and time, you know? I mean, those two dates you can't forget, or you better not forget. When I woke from a brief nap in my original report, I told my wife I was going to bed, and it was 8:30. It was a digital clock on the television, and that's when I walked into the bedroom, and the window was open, and I closed the window, and that's when I seen the lights, and they were angled down, and I thought at first it was going to be a plane crash. Because we're just southeast of Sky Harbor Airport by about 23 miles, so we get a lot of air traffic out by where we live that's very low altitude. The angle, the lights and the angle and everything, I thought we was going to see a plane crash, and that's why we ran outside.
You say it was a chevron shape. This is not what most people commonly assume are the Phoenix lights, right?
Well, there's a lot of mixture and intentional mixture that's going on here. The V-shape, chevron shape, boomerang shape in the 8 o'clock hour. When you talk about what they've seen in the five videos in the 10 o'clock hour of what I call the intentional diversion of the military flare drop, those there are just rounded lights. Nobody knows what that is because nobody got really close enough to them. There's only a handful of people that saw those. And those are the videos that's all over the world that everybody gets to see. Actually, there was less than a dozen witnesses to those lights. What I talk about and what we saw in the 8 o'clock hour, pretty much everybody saw pretty much the same thing. V-shape, chevron-shape, boomerang-shape, they all apply.
How many people have you heard about that saw the chevron shape originally?
I'm still getting witnesses, even 10 years after the fact. I did some newspaper and radio shows up here, and there are people sending me emails. I would say that I personally have talked to over 500 people. I'm not an investigator or a witness. I'm just a witness myself. I don't call myself a UFO investigator or anything. I'm just trying to find witnesses.
So 500 people actually saw the chevron shape.
It's in the thousands, Earl. There was never an attempt by any means of whether it's city, local, federal, state, police, radio, TV. Nobody went out of their way to try to find out the actual number of witnesses. What they did in the early hours of the next day and the following days was actually make fun and harass these witnesses and tease them of what they saw, and that shied a lot of people away from making a report.
Was it the governor of Arizona who had somebody show up in an alien costume?
That was true, and that was a big disappointment to a lot of people, including people in the media, because he was going to have an earth-shattering report to the people in the press, and then it turned out to be one of his people came out in an alien suit and said, "You people are taking this way too serious," and they laughed it off. And that's pretty much the reception witnesses get, Earl, when you come forward with this. They don't really want to know. They want to get rid of it. They want to debunk you, and they want to, you know, make it look like you were under the influence or that you're not very intelligent. Debunkers get on the media and they say these people shouldn't even be looking up. It goes on.
This happens not just in Phoenix, but it happens everywhere. You get the giggle factor, the tee-hees. You people are tinfoil hat wearing crazies.
You develop a thicker skin if you want to pursue the truth. And that's what it's all about. The object that I seen from the nose of the craft to the end of the left wing that passed in front of us, and it didn't pass over our heads, it passed in front of us. And when I put out my hand at the nose of the craft and my right hand at the tail of the craft, it was well over 30 inches long. And for something like that, I was raised in the Air Force, I'm ex-Navy, you know, to something that big, that was that low, that slow, and did not make any noise, you want to pursue and try to find out just what it was.
And your description, along with a clip that I've used several times over the years on Strange Days Indeed, I want to play you that clip right now, actually.
Okay.
And this is another description, presumably, of the same object.
It was a giant V, all right? And the right side of the V went over us. The left side was like a couple blocks over it. But I could see up inside that it was almost like a recess, and it had fluorescent like light inside, like a gas light of some kind.
You could see right through the middle of it, but it was like looking through two-way glass, like through a mirage that you see on the highway or something.
That's pretty much your description too.
There's hundreds of witnesses that'll say the same thing. A lot of them have, that I've talked to, when the object passed over their heads in the dark black sky above, is when it passed through a bright star, it was like looking through water. And it was. For some reason, the way it handled bright light was amazing. And the light that it put out was amazing. It was just a pure light. It defies the words that's in our dictionary. It did in size and in description. It caught everybody off guard to the point that it's really hard to describe. So many witnesses, Earl, they would use multiple football fields, multiple baseball fields, multiple aircraft carriers. They was thinking of the largest object they could think of and then multiplying it by 2, 3, and 4 to really come to what the exact profound size was.
You say 500, if not thousands of people saw this object.
Oh, easy. Francis Barwood got over 800 calls. Michael Tanner at Village Labs, I know he fielded a couple thousand calls. Who are you going to call? You know, I mean, that's the thing. There's nothing in the phone book or the white pages or yellow pages. You know, you can't really call 911 emergency fire and police. Radio and TV, they have a receptionist there that's probably minimum wage, and they don't really care. There's no way of really going out and finding out how many witnesses there truly was from Kingman to Tucson and back up between 5:30 p.m. that evening till well about 2 o'clock in the morning on the 14th of March.
You mentioned Frances Barwood, Frances Emma Barwood.
Yes.
What was she? She was a councilwoman there in
Phoenix?
She
was a Phoenix councilwoman in the Scottsdale district. Her and I have known each other now for right at 10 years. As soon as she asked during a council meeting, why don't we investigate and see what this was, from that point in time, it was all downhill for her. And there's no more politics for a person that says something like that, unfortunately. So she lost her reelection bid, and she is now retired. But ever since she made that call, they put her in the newspaper as they made her out to be kind of a wacko because she asked that question, when actually she was quite sincere. From that point in time, she probably fielded 700 to 800 phone calls. And she turned all that information over to Michael Tanner at Village Lab.
So that happened at, 8 o'clock in the evening?
What we saw, and I lived in Chandler, Arizona, which is southeast of Phoenix, what we saw was at 8:30. There's two known early reports, one at 5:30 in Crown King, which all three of the V-shaped objects were seen at one time. And then the first path, I guess the first beginning of it, was 8:16 in Paulden, which is north of Prescott by probably about 25 or 30 miles. And that's the first call-in of the V-shaped formation.
The first call-in went to who?
From what I see, the 816 caller was from Paulden, Arizona, and he called the National UFO Reporting Center. Now, they have him originally as a retired policeman. The reality is he's a retired Army major. I've spoken with him. He called it into the National UFO Reporting Center.
In Washington State.
In Seattle, Washington.
In Seattle, Washington. Peter Davenport, right. So that got called in. Do you have any records of other calls that came in?
Two of the most interesting ones was after it left Paulden, the next town heading south out of that was Chino Valley. And at Chino Valley, there was a report of a retired Navy admiral who was flying a twin Cessna Golden Eagle. He was at about 3,500 foot altitude, and he's the one that radioed Luke Air Force Base that a large, massive black object is heading their way. It passed under his aircraft, and at that point in time, he radioed Luke. He was the first one to radio Luke Air Force Base just to the west of Phoenix. That's something indeed very mysterious was heading their way.
The reports and the credible reports are actually substantial.
Oh, without question. As you head a little bit further south, there's a flight trainer for Embry-Riddle, and he had a student pilot, and they were at about 3,000 foot altitude, and they looked down, and when they looked down, it looked like the city lights had gone out, and they stayed with it, and then they realized that a black boomerang or V-shaped craft had just passed under them, and they literally feared for their lives. They thought they were going to die, and it just silently passed under them and on its way towards Phoenix. This flight instructor with Embry-Riddle would not do a video report, nor would the student pilot, who now is, I think he's a major in the Air Force.
Mm.
The really weird thing about all this, Earl, is how everything is debunked. For years and years and years, everybody thought it was flares that actually passed through the state of Arizona. They wrote it off as flares. Now, if you think about flares traveling hundreds of miles in the same altitude, and most people will know what a flare looks like. It burns, it has smoke, there's a parachute. It's obvious what we saw was a craft, there's no question, and there's hundreds of people that will tell you what they saw was not of this earth, and it was not ours, it was not a flare, it was a craft, it was a one object, it was one piece. And every time they do a story in the paper, you know, I end up getting 50 to 75 more emails. There's a lot of people saw it, but there's just a lot of people don't want to talk about it.
500 to 1,000 people saw the boomerang shape at around 8:15, 8:30 on March 13th. 1997. Why do you think, a lot of people think, was a flare drop over the city?
That's where the confusion of the media and actually an intentional debunking comes in. In my opinion, in the five videos that were taken and shot around 10 o'clock p.m., those five videos show a flare drop over Barry Goldwater Range or at the north end of Barry Goldwater, which as a crow flies from Phoenix would probably be 45 to 50 miles southwest of Phoenix. Dr. Bruce McAbee did a triangulation for these videos, and the triangulation showed that they had to have been ignited around 17,000 foot. Now, the standard operating procedure of the LUU-2 flare dropped by an A-10 calls for it to be dropped at 6,000 foot altitude, it ignites at 3,000 foot altitude, and it extinguishes at 500 foot. Now, if that's done at Barry Goldwater, it would never be seen by anybody in Phoenix, regardless of living on a mountainside home. But the intentional drop at 10 o'clock was to divert attention away from the earlier events. No question about that. I'm sure you've been reading the stories I've been posting on Frank Warren's blog that also goes to your site and to Stewart's site, UFO Review. These stories about these witnesses it stopped a Little League game in progress. If you've ever had a child in Little League, nothing stops that game because they're on time limits. And as this craft passed over these kids playing baseball, I mean, everybody just stopped and stared at this thing in disbelief as it was passing over their heads. We had a helicopter pilot at 8:25 in North Phoenix. There were search and rescue crews doing practice rescues on the mountain. As this passed over them, the helicopter pilot refused to go up and check it out and see what it was.
Who can blame him?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, it wasn't scary. It wasn't threatening. It wasn't anything. It was peaceful. Almost all, everybody will tell you just how benevolent and how peaceful this was. And we have an airline captain, a retired airline captain by the name of Trigg Johnston. This was at 10:20 p.m. up in Cave Creek, way up north of Phoenix. And as the large craft passed over his head and his son's head, he said in his report that it had an inside area of over a square mile, And as it passed over his head, he was given a telepathic message, we are not a threat. And we have two witnesses who are given these type of messages.
Another thing I hadn't heard about.
The Bradley Evans family was coming up from Tucson to Phoenix for a swim meet. And as it was, one of these objects was heading south of the interstate, they were heading north. As it passed over their object, it reversed itself and followed them backwards going north. And let me repeat that. The object's heading south from the north. They're heading north from the south as the object got over their car. And they're on the interstate going 75 miles an hour. As the object got over their car, it reversed itself and now was heading north backwards. And she was told, do not stop. This does not concern you. Keep on driving.
Telepathically, she was told this.
Yes, and she's a professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson. See, these reports don't really get out. They're in a couple books, but no media will pick them up. There's an exit off the interstate north of Phoenix, about 80 miles, and there's an exit called Sunset Point. It was 5:30 p.m., still daylight. Three of these V-shaped objects were all seen at the same time. People were pulling off the interstate and watching these things in awe. And in the report, it said two fighter jets were coming up from the south. These three V-shaped objects pancaked on top of themselves, forming one object, then turned into a white ball of light and vanished.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody is going to touch that in the media.
No, of course not.
But we have, I mean, there are written reports. It's in Bill Hamilton's book. It's in Dr. Lynn's book. What are you going to do? I mean, you present that. There's not a TV station in town that's going to cover that. It's just too far out there, and it would probably cause a panic. The only threat was when they saw the fighter jets coming up, and they thought there was going to be something happen. You know, most of that's probably out of Hollywood movies.
Let's go back to the flare drop. Now, you said the flares apparently were dropped at 17,000 feet.
The triangulation by Dr. McAbee, and I'm sure you've heard of Dr. Bruce McAbee.
Of course, yes.
His triangulation was they had to have been ignited. See, that's the thing, not dropped, but ignited at 16 or 17,000 foot in order to be seen by the mountainside homes in Phoenix. The truth is, no one was close enough to those lights to actually determine what they were. Nobody really knows. It's just that we're constantly being bombarded by the Air Force that they were flares. Nobody was within 40 or 45 miles of these lights, so the truth is no one really knows what they are.
Mm-hmm.
But they resemble flares.
So the next question is, how long did they hang in the air?
I did not see them personally myself. In the videos that I have and the testimony of the ones that shot it was 3 to 5 minutes, somewhere around in there.
And what's the life expectancy of one of these flares, or the light expectancy?
That's a good question, but I believe we're probably 4 to 5 minutes, somewhere around in there. About the same time in duration.
About the same time in duration.
Yes. That got all the publicity. See, when you talk to TV producers, they'll tell you, we can't really tell a story like an 8 o'clock witnesses story if we don't have video to back it up. We need video, and they don't respect the public. They feel the public will not listen to a story unless they see video. So whenever they interview a witness like myself, that's an 8:30 witness, they'll show the 10 o'clock flare footage in the background, and it confuses everybody.
Yes, and documentaries are all guilty of just grabbing any sort of footage to illustrate what it is that they're talking about.
Yes.
And I see that happen over and over again in documentaries, as I'm sure you've seen and
yes.
The listeners have
seen. Oh, I've been in many, 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 many stories with producers over this, including Peter Jennings, UFO Seeing is Believing. I've done probably 50 televised interviews. The best by far was Out of the Blue, the documentary.
Yes.
Out of the Blue was wonderful.
Wonderful.
They really did a good job.
The guys sent me a copy of their DVD before it was cut for television or edited for television.
Yes.
And even the extras are wonderful in it.
Yes.
And if you, the listener, can grab yourself a copy of that, Out of the Blue is the name of it, and you want to see a wonderful UFO documentary, that's certainly one to get a hold of.
If I could say, if they searched Google and went to Out of the Blue documentary, it'd take you right to it.
I think they're at outoftheblue.tv, aren't they? That's their website.
That's when it showed that Sci-Fi Channel carried it for a couple of years. I don't know if you can still order it from that point. I've talked to James Fox. He's the one who went out and shot all the footage, did a really good job.
Yes, he did.
Like a lot of them, they'll present the facts, and then at the end they'll debunk everything. And it's almost like they feel they're obligated to do this to keep their FCC license or their advertisers or mm-hmm. whatever it is, you know. But, you know, I can understand it if they get hoaxed and they fell for it. They don't want to have egg on their face. But when you have thousands of witnesses And you have people from all walks of life, from pilots to doctors to psychiatrists to professors to truck drivers to salespeople like myself. And they're all saying the same thing, and they're from all over the state. Truly, after 10 years, we should listen.
Are you holding your breath?
No. What I've written before is maybe in about 40 years, somebody will actually start investigating this, and all the witnesses will either be dead or senile. Kind of like Roswell, you know, they waited 50 years to really, really get into Roswell, and they're still talking about it 60 years after the fact, and it's too bad. It really is. It's just too bad.
Yeah.
Now, if one of those large objects would have landed out here, and this is how I feel, and a being would have came out of that ship, and that being would have said, you know, I bring you peace, I can cure your cancers, I can get rid of your fossil fuels and all this, we will kill him, and we'll dissect him, and we'll back engineer his ship for weapons. And we're about weapons. It's all about weapons. And I think maybe our visitors may be aware of that.
Oh, I'm sure they are.
And that's one reason why there's no contact.
Shoot first, ask questions
later.
Well,
we're about weapons. I mean, we want the weapons before the Chinese or the Iraqis or the North Koreans. We want them now. We don't want the Chinese to get these weapons. We want them. And we're still barbarians. Think about it. We think we're the most civilized nation in the earth, and yet we're the most barbaric. I mean, we're about weapons and killing. I mean, it's been that way for thousands of years.
And it goes on in the Middle East.
It's never stopped. It'll never stop.
Yes.
There are people out there that did see this, that are part of this. I'm doing a radio show here in Prescott this week where we're trying to find the couple that did videotape at 825, the object as it passed over Prescott Valley.
Yes.
And there's always been word that that video did exist. I'm even going to offer a $1,000 reward. They just give me the tape, no questions asked. But it's been 10 years, and you just wonder how much that tape has deteriorated.
I would chip in for that, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners would, too.
Well, it'd just be interesting if it was good video and actually showed the crowd.
Yes.
If I would have had a movie camera, me and my wife were standing there as this thing passed in front of us. If I would have shot it with a good Zero Lux camera, I would have got the entire thing. Even in wide angle, I wouldn't be able to get it all in one scene. I'd have had to move it to get it all in. If I would have done that, then we wouldn't even be talking about the flares anymore. If I would have survived, that video would be a classic.
You mentioned earlier on Dr. Lynn Kitai. Didn't she shoot video of these objects or the object?
Well, that's a touchy subject. And she is one of the 5 10 o'clock videos that shot towards angled towards the southwest. Her tape was one of them. Hers, Chuck Reardon's, and Mike Christian, all three of those videos were in Dr. Bruce McAbee's triangulation. He determined that they were distant flares. She argues that vehemently. That is her involvement. She adds 35 millimeters that were taken before and after. I'm into March 13th, not before or after. What happened March 13th was unique itself. You know, I don't need to throw all these other things in and then call it a documentary. And a documentary is a film of fact, and therefore we've gone over bounds on that. We don't talk anymore, let's put it that way. I'm in her video a lot. I'm her main 830 witness and everything, but it's just gone to a higher level. There's no proof of what that distant footage is.
Right.
You can't claim it to be something when it's 50 miles away when we don't know for sure. You can say it might be, but don't say it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we kind of butt heads a little bit. And I was in bed when the 10 o'clock sightings hit. You know, after our signing at 8:30, we looked around for a few minutes. We went back inside. We were almost in a state of shock. I mean, my wife and I, we just stared at each other 10, 15, 20 minutes. And I said, you know, we just saw our first UFO. And she looked back at me and said, I know.
Mm.
And we went back outside and we looked around for 5 minutes or so. And we felt at that time, Earl, we truly did, that we were the only ones that saw this because it was quiet. If you were not outside looking up at that time, even though Hal Bopp was out there, you would not have seen this. Because it was quiet. Just the physics of something this size that was so low and so slow, the inertia that would keep it aloft, I mean, it would have been deafening in our standards. I said in my initial report, you could chase this with a car and not get a speeding ticket.
That's incredible. Were there others around that date in the area around Phoenix or in that part of Arizona?
I'm not aware of anything before or after. Now, Mike Christian, one of the videographers that shot the 10 o'clock southwest of Phoenix, said he saw the lights the night before. And that's why Bill Hamilton and Tom King were at his home there in Ahwatukee, just south of Phoenix. That's why they were there. He had called MUFON, Arizona, and Bill and Tom King went out there, And that's when they reappeared for them around 10 o'clock at night.
The flares, what we think of
that's
the flares.
That's what we think are.
Yeah.
Who knows? To me, it is until they prove otherwise, and it can't be proven otherwise because there's never been a witness found between Ahwatukee and the light itself, the lights itself.
Hmm.
So until you get somebody that was closer, that maybe got better video, or we get a lot of witnesses that saw it that were under it, say in Casa Grande, around that area, and we haven't found that person in 10 years, so doesn't look very fruitful that we will.
I want to go back to the video that you think exists or that you've heard exists, an elderly couple, you said.
Yes.
How did that story first surface, that there was possibly video footage of this boomerang?
Supposedly, the daughter-in-law saw the video at their home being played for the family. And the daughter-in-law had said something, either at work or at a beauty parlor or at the grocery stores. The daughter-in-law is the one that first leaked it out. And then it got to somebody that got to somebody that got to somebody like me. And then to Michael Tanner, actually, is where I got the story. And from that point of time, it's just pretty much urban legend.
And you've tried to track it back.
Well, about a year ago, Eyes on the Sky was done by the Prescott Courier up here. It was a full-page article on my wife and I. And it told them that one of my goals up here was to find that video. And my email address was in the story. And I was trying roughly to do it that way. You never know that they got to read the article or anybody showed them the article. Or
yeah, that's it. If they're not in the right place at the right time with the right newspaper.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go door to door on something like this. And then again, it may not exist. We don't know. It's just we're trying.
Mm.
It would answer a lot of questions if a really good quality video did exist.
The chances are of a really good quality video existing are
nil.
Well, 10 years ago, the video technology wasn't that wonderful. Not the way it is today.
No. As a matter of fact, it was probably VHS.
Yes.
And that tape degrades in time. If it's not kept in a good atmosphere and in a good moisture area, I would think that tape would degrade.
Yes.
It would lose its moisture and it could become very brittle and probably break.
Mm-hmm.
So in all honesty, you know, maybe we're just throwing darts.
Maybe
they downloaded it to a disc. We can only hope. I mean,
I seriously wish you luck on it. And I trust that your appearances in the neighborhood in the next few days will bring forth that videotape.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm actually truly going to offer $1,000. Now, that might wake somebody up. $1,000 for an old tape, you know, hey, sure, here it is. I was going to tell you, is Francis Barwood received a phone call from a guy who videotaped a 1020 sighting. It was Trigg Johnson's sighting of the object that was heading south at 1020 from Cave Creek towards Phoenix. And this guy was in Phoenix, and he videotaped this. And he called Francis Barwood during a radio show in Phoenix. And he said, I did videotape it, I have it, and you can have this. And it wasn't 30 minutes later that two guys dressed in black, and I know what this sounds like, but they were in dark suits, hats, and sunglasses, knocked on his door, and they said, we're from Francis Barwood's office, and we're here for the tape, and he gave it to him.
Oh, no.
Yes, that's in her story. That's been written about, you know. What are you going to do?
So we have this staggering story with descriptions of not one, but two or three of these big flying chevrons or flying Vs. We have hundreds of witnesses. We have what appears to be a cover-up by getting the Air Force to drop flares very close to city limits, I would think, if not over the city.
Yes.
But at 17,000 feet, and for what purpose, when they used to illuminate the ground, not the sky.
Well, exactly. To illuminate troops and military hardware on the ground, not 3 miles up.
Not 3 miles up, but they dropped those things not from a mile up, but from about 6,000 feet.
Now, here's something interesting, and I'd like to say this. This is very important, is what the military said about the 8 o'clock events. And what they said, they didn't say that they didn't happen. They didn't say that they were flares. It was the media that keeps harping the flare story so much. But what the government's response was, the military's response was, at no point in time was there a threat to our national security. That's what they released.
That's what the government said when they closed down Project Boo Boo.
There was never a threat to our national security. That's correct.
Yes.
As a military person, I was born in the Air Force and I'm ex-Navy. And whenever somebody says that there's not a threat, that means it's a friendly.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the two. So So they didn't say it didn't happen. They didn't say anything else. They just said there was never a threat to our national security. That pretty much goes to what the retired airline captain, Trigg Johnson, was told telepathically at 10:20, we are not a threat. And what Mrs. Evans was told when she was driving north, they said, keep on driving, do not stop, this does not concern you. All the witnesses will tell you it wasn't threatening at all. They didn't feel like getting a gun, jumping under the bed, running to the mountains, or getting the heck out of Arizona. That wasn't it. They'll tell you how peaceful it was, that there was, in fact, a benevolence there.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story, Mike. It really is. And, oh, Lord, I wish we could get to the bottom of it. But then that's what I wish every week as I do this program.
I agree. And you know what? I think we'll find out in time. I don't think that we're ready yet. Like I said, I think there will be a violent end if it were to land. That we're about weapons. We're not about meeting and greeting somebody else. I mean, we're going to be in denial. It'll be cleaned up in moments. It'll be denied. We'll back engineer for weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We're just not ready. I don't think we're civilized enough.
Mike, give us your email address if people want to get a hold of you.
It's satmike, SATMIKE, at cable1one.net.
That's SAT, sat, as in satellite, satmike, at
cable1, CABLEONE. .net.
Cable1.net.
Yes, sir.
Let me thank you, Mike Fortson, for
well,
this.
Well, thank you too, Earl.
We have yet another fascinating story. There are just so many. I mean, you look at what happened back in the fall of last year at Chicago O'Hare International.
Absolutely.
And all through the last 30, 40 years, we've had amazing, amazing reports by credible, reliable witnesses.
I agree.
We still haven't come up with a solution for any of it.
All we do is lie about it.
Yeah. Well, we don't. But
well, all we're told is lies.
The people that we pay to represent us is what it is.
They don't have time for this. There's no money in this for them. So, really, why would they get involved?
Exactly. Again, Mike Fortson, thank you, sir. And
you're welcome.
Happy 10th anniversary.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. We will be outside.
And make sure you have a video camera with you this time.
With me every minute. It doesn't leave my side.
Thank you again, Mike Fortson.
You're more than welcome.
We'll keep in touch and see
yes,
what
sir,
goes on.
Yes, sir, you have my number.
I do, and you've got mine.
Oh, I'm in your side every day, several times.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
We'll talk to you again.
Bye.
Bye.
Woke up this morning with light in my eyes, and then realized it was still dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
Any observation of the 10th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights on March 13th, 2007 would, of course, be incomplete without Dr. Lynn Kitai, a medical doctor down there in Phoenix, Arizona, who has made a documentary called The Phoenix Lights and has just recently revamped it and re-released it, also written a book on the Phoenix Lights. So let us head down to Phoenix, Arizona, and Dr. Lynn Kitai joins us. Hello, Dr. Lynn.
Hello, Earl. This is such a joy, as always, to share the information with your listening audience.
It's good to have you back on the program again. I think it was several years now, it seems to me,
mm-hmm.
At least 100 programs ago.
A lot has happened, and there's a lot more to the story than just March 13th, but certainly for anyone who isn't familiar with the mass sighting evening, which we're celebrating the 10th anniversary. It's just awesome and amazing and wonderful that the mass sighting has really become an historic event in the annals of ufology and certainly is still unexplained. When thousands of people were outside on a very clear, quiet night like it is right now, it's just beautiful in the evenings, but purposely not only outside doing their thing, whether they were, you know, at the baseball field or going to the mall or whatever, but thousands were outside looking up at the sky at the Hale-Bopp Comet that evening, which was very clear in the northwest sky, when they also saw traverse right over their heads, I mean, very low altitude, a mile to 2 mile wide in some estimations, formation of lights, equidistant lights that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't quite see what it was attached to, kind of a shimmering, maybe a force field in between these lights. Or some people actually saw a craft, gunmetal on the bottom and windows and beings looking at them through the windows, all of the above, whether there was a parade going through the whole state or this was one thing that, that morphed into different things, we don't know for sure. But certainly the first call came in, even though it started way before this call. I have, since coming forward 3 years ago, after staying anonymous for 7 years, not wanting to come forward, but certainly finding after looking for a logical explanation, pushing my entire professional medical career aside for 4 years to find a logical source and meaning for what I had witnessed and photographed, not only the mass sighting night, but 2 months before that was verified the next morning by air traffic controllers. They saw the same thing in restricted airspace in front of the mountain here on top of Phoenix, as well as 2 years before, and I have the same formation of lights in the same location then as well. But besides that, after pushing my professional life aside and then finding out that there's so much more to this topic, I knew nothing about this. But then on March 13th, thousands of people were experiencing these phenomena very slowly gliding over their heads, about 30 miles an hour. Some people did see it take off at a tremendous speed. Incredible technology, to be sure. Totally silent. That was what was most eerie to everyone, that it was so massive and so silent. And not only the fact that it went throughout the entire state, as I was saying, the first call came in, retired police officer called in to report this phenomena in Paulden, Arizona, which is northwest Arizona, and the thing traveled throughout the most populated corridor of Arizona, all the way down to Tucson and then back to Phoenix, and that's when most of the calls came in, because most of the people were outside and it was dark and they were looking up at the sky. Mm. But we have reports as early as 5 p.m., not just in Arizona, but I have Native Americans that got in touch with me that were actually seeing these phenomena in New Mexico, as well as others that were seeing it in Nevada and California up to 2 a.m. So there was a lot going on that night of something quite spectacular and mind-changing. I mean, this has really, really changed the face of these phenomena in the Phoenix and Arizona area, because many people saw it, and many people were still wondering what it was.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people.
Oh, yeah, we estimate over 10,000 people, and they're still coming. I just got a call a couple of months ago from, this was interesting, from a commercial airline pilot. She is now retired, but at the time, she actually saw the same phenomena about 11:30 at night near Las Vegas as she was flying to California. And what's really interesting is that about a half hour later, and she called into the tower, by the way, to find out if they were seeing anything on radar, which they weren't, and another commercial airline pilot called in about the same time, and he was all frantic because he was seeing it too, and he was very alarmed. And as she got closer, about a half hour later, to California, suddenly there was an Air Force jet right next to them, right next to this commercial airline, freaking out the passengers and the crew, sending off flares.
Whoa.
She just got in touch with me. We met, and she's very credible, and she's the real deal. And she said, I just had to share that with you because, you know, there's so much flying around that's misinformation or disinformation. And hear that story. I mean, that's pretty impressive. Why did that occur, you know?
Yes. Now, what was it that she saw?
Well, she saw the lights that seemed to be attached to something, a mile-wide formation, deformation of lights. That was very near to where they were flying.
So boomerang-shaped, chevron-shaped as those objects that were seen back in 1997.
Yeah, different people saw different things. You know, whether it was our own perception or there was a parade of different objects, some people saw a boomerang, most people saw a triangle. Most people say that they saw a V-shaped formation of five lights with two trailing. My very first sighting, and I had no interest or knowledge in this topic at all, was in 1995, February of 95. We lived mountainside in Paradise Valley, which is quite far from any kind of military thing. And we're nestled into the mountains. We have a private gated area. And we actually saw right outside our bedroom window, about 100 yards from our home, a little below us, and the pictures indicate that, were three amber orbs in a triangle formation like a pyramid, one on top and two closely aligned underneath. And I call them orbs because the light did not extend outside the edge. It's very self-contained and mesmerizing, a uniform color throughout. I really took everything in mentally because I didn't want to budge when I saw them. My husband called me to our bedroom window, which is a big window, and I just stared at them and wondering, what is this? What is this? I mean, what is this technology? I couldn't imagine this advanced technology. The light didn't glare at all, and I finally grabbed my 35 millimeter and got a picture of the two bottom orbs and wondered, you know, what the heck this was, besides the fact that there was an eerie silence, and it felt like something was watching. I mean, I have to admit that. It took me a long time to admit that, but it felt like, as intently as I was watching these two bottom orbs, something was watching me, and going through my mind, I was thinking, who are you? What are you? Do you know that I'm here? I'd love to meet you. And the next thing I remember, the left bottom orb started to dissipate, and I quickly shot a picture of that. Well, a couple of significant things. Number one, when we saw these orbs disappear, the only thing, because we don't have a reference for it, the only thing I could liken it to, because it felt like it was still there. When they all disappeared, it felt like they were still there, even though we didn't see them.
Yes.
Did they go to another dimension? That's all that I could conceive of in our limited reference for this. That's number one. Number two, in closer scrutiny of these pictures, which, by the way, have confirmed for me at the time that we did see something unusual, but I had no idea what it could have been in a private gated area about 50, 75 feet off the ground. But we did notice that this same formation, the same mile-wide equidistant formation of lights was in the background in the same spot. And this is really significant, Earl, because the data speaks for itself. This is important stuff. I mean, I have photographic documentation that proves that the same formation was in the same location 2 years before the mass sighting and 2 months before the mass sighting, because the lights came back 2 mm-hmm. months before the mass sighting. And I happened to catch the second day of these sightings, the same formation in the same location, head-on, turning into a V-shape, 6 pictures in a row. And I put the first and the last picture on the website, www.thephoenixlights.net, if anyone wants to take a peek at it. The first one, I was shaking. It was so unnerving. When this popped up, it was so massive. And not having an explanation for the 95 sighting, I started clicking away, but I was shaking initially. And I did catch not only a picture, the second picture was what people would describe statewide on March 13th. Many people would describe these 5 lights in a V formation with 2 trailing. And the picture is indicative of that. And then the last picture that I posted is really interesting in itself. Once it turned, and you could see that it was a V, and like you said, people were seeing boomerangs and chevron shape and arrowhead shape, Tom King and Bill Hamilton's footage is spectacular. I mean, you look at that footage, which is also posted on my web in the Fox Report, those lights are attached to something. But be that as it may, if it was different things or one thing that could change, in that picture, that second picture on my website, you can see that every other light is bigger than the one in between. And if you postulate, and this is just postulation here, but you can imagine if there is a force field, which many people believe that there was when they saw it up close and personal, in between these orbs, you can see that the bigger orbs are the closer arm and the further away orbs would be the smaller orbs. And it just makes sense. So that in itself proves that there was something that had lights attached to it. After that sighting, 2 months before the mass sighting, it was so unnerving that I had to find a logical explanation. And I called around and finally found air traffic controllers. And this is very important data as well, because they were even more excited than I was that they had seen this and that I had seen it at a distance. But not only did it not show up on radar, and they were alarmed because this was in restricted airspace. They took their binoculars to look, and in their own words, they saw 6 points of light totally equidistant from each other over a mile span that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't see what it was attached to. And it moved slowly in tandem behind South Mountain, behind the airport. When I asked, well, what was it? There was silence. And finally, I said, beats me. And I said, so you're an air traffic controller. You're supposed to know it's in our airspace. And they were just as intrigued that I had seen it. And at the same exact time, and we kept in communication, I talked to them the day after the mass sighting. For me, it was just another night. It was just a regular night. But here I had caught the footage that a lot of people have seen of the 3 points of light, like a giant triangle over the city. And I called the next morning to see if they saw it, and we confirmed. and a number of people confirmed with me, air traffic controllers that saw it both times. It was the same exact formation in the same exact location, did not show up on radar, and it was definitely in restricted airspace. In fact, they also shared that a pilot called in that was approaching Sky Harbor Airport that said, what the hell are these lights over me? So, you know, I mean, there's so much information that is so intriguing and so important and, you know, got brushed under the carpet. But after the mass sighting, when thousands of people saw what I had been seeing, and I found out a week later that we had an expert right here, Jim Dellatoso, who was showing from his database of pictures and footage that these orbs have been seen worldwide, that blew me away. I had no idea. I knew nothing about this topic. And now I'm hearing not only that thousands of people saw what I had seen, but now that it's happening worldwide. And that sent me on a journey to find out a logical source and meaning for what I had witnessed and photographed. And I pushed my entire professional life, as you know, aside for 4 years to try to really get to the bottom of this. And if anything, my meticulous inquiry really opened up a whole new world to me that I had no idea existed. I found out such intriguing information, and that there actually were scientists studying these things for 20, 30 years. I had no idea, and ended up with a 750-page journal, which I didn't know what to do with. I really, not only the history of all this and the other worldwide sightings that are similar and cultures that are much more open to these things as being unearthly, but I continued to take amazing pictures. And the one that really blows me away is the one I took 1 month after 9/11 that's on the cover of our documentary. And there's just so much more to this story. But, you know, you kind of know, you spoke to me way back then.
Yes.
And you know how apprehensive I was about coming forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great risk to both my professional and personal life. But, you know, Earl, what's really ironic is that for the last 30 years, I have dedicated my life's work and my own heart and pocket to community education of vital health issues. And I have curriculum out there for schools from K through college on the reality of AIDS and teen pregnancy and substance abuse prevention education distributed by Discovery Education worldwide, which I'm very proud of. And I felt obliged when I finally really got a hold of all this incredibly intriguing and important data to share the reality of this vital topic.
It's really remarkable, Dr. Lynn, that so many people have seen these chevrons, these boomerangs, these V-shaped objects. And I say objects plural because there have been many reports of three of these things, not just the large single one that was seen over the city.
Right.
Other people have seen them and seen three of them, and two of them fly over the top of the third and merge into it.
Right. I have pictures of that, actually. My whole purpose in coming forward was not only to let people know that it's okay to talk about this topic and get it out in the open and accept it and address it and study it. I mean, it's time we move forward in that behalf, but also that there is so much data out there, and certainly for the educational community, it's important to open their minds to this. And yesterday, we actually were featured at the Arizona State University Anthropology Museum. They have an exhibit there through August that opened last night of not only the Phoenix lights and the pictures that I've taken, but besides that, Wendell Stevens participated, and there's some wonderful, wonderful pictures, including a picture that blew me away when I first saw it of three disc-shaped objects in the same formation as my nighttime pictures. It's mind-boggling. It's just mind-boggling what's really going on out there.
What amazes me is, in the same way that you saw what you saw in Arizona, other people around the world, as you said, have been seeing the same things.
Absolutely.
And it's reported countless times that that's occurring.
Right, and there's a history to this. I mean,
yes,
from the time of human documentation. I mean, when we look at the primitive caves in Pakistan, there are what we would call UFOs in their drawings. And how did they get that idea? Unless they were drawing what they had seen. And certainly in the Bible, there's indications that these things were going on and people were witnessing them, as well as paintings in the 17th and 18th century. I mean, this goes way, way back. And in fact, last week we also had, to celebrate the 10th anniversary, we had a witness forum which I think is very important. It's so healing to be able to talk about this as a physician. I certainly, and an experiencer, I certainly can empathize with people who have been just keeping it inside for since they were children and afraid to talk about this. Even though most things can be explained, it was real to them. And just being able to talk about it is really cathartic. And we had one gentleman who shared with the audience. He was an 85-year-old French gentleman who was actually a pilot during World War II. And, of course, we've heard about the Foo Fighters. Well, he saw
of
the
course,
Foo Fighters.
Of course,
he actually
yes.
experienced it.
Yeah.
And he thought that, you know, somebody had this advanced technology, as did every side think that the other side had this advanced technology. And it wasn't until after the war that he found out, as well as others, that nobody had this kind of technology. So these phenomena have been around for a long, long time. Just in our culture, particularly in the United States, there are cultures right here in Arizona that are very open to these phenomena as being unearthly. In fact, it's important to note that the Gila River Indian Reservation, which is in between the South Mountain, which is behind the airport, and there's a basin in between South Mountain and the Estrella Mountain Range. Well, Estrella means star in Spanish. They call it the gateway to the stars. I went to them serendipitously, and I have to say that my presentation is now called, I have a PowerPoint presentation where I really get it all out there. It's fascinating, called Coincidence or Communication, because too many things were so serendipitous around the sightings that I captured on film. And this is just another example. 6 months before the mass sighting, I was invited to present my substance abuse prevention program at the Gila River Indian Reservation, and very few people even get to visit the area. And I talked with several people there, and so after the mass sighting, when my pictures indicated that they seemed to be showing up in that area, I wondered if they had seen them and gave them a call, and they started to laugh. And I said, is that funny? And they said, are you kidding? We've been looking up at them for centuries. We call them sky people light beings.
Yes.
I mean, they're part of their culture.
Yes.
They feel
yeah.
that they're ancestors that are coming to visit them.
And the same thing happened to John Mack in Australia when he and his research assistant went to visit an Aboriginal reserve hundreds and hundreds of miles out in the bush. And he somewhat trepidatiously broached the subject with the medicine man and said, have your people seen things in the sky? The Aboriginal said, oh, you mean the flying saucers? Oh, yeah, we see them all the time, and we see them on TV as well.
Right.
On
right
the satellite dish.
Right. Oh, geez. It's mind-boggling that our culture, especially in the United States, has really put a lid on talking about this and the reality of this. I mean, we're told constantly that even though they came out in 1969 when Blue Book was closed with UFOs are not a threat to national security, well, how did they know that, okay? And there is no indication, by the way, 10 years later, there is not one report of threat, harm, or abduction associated with the Phoenix Lights event, not one. But that being said, it's just been ridiculed and criticized. Whereas now I think with the technology that we have and with people really starting to open up to the possibilities that we're not alone, it cannot be denied.
What fascinated me was the fact that many of the witnesses to the Phoenix incidents, and not just Phoenix but the outlying areas, because these things were seen for hundreds of miles, what they were told and what they were told telepathically was, we are not going to harm you.
Yes.
In fact, it's like Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Don't panic.
Exactly. That is such an important point. And that was one of the reasons I came forward too, Earl, because here, when you really look at the data, and I don't even like to address the flare thing anymore. If you want to talk about the fact that there was no explanation, total denial that anything was in the air by the military for 5 months until the USA Today article came out and opened it up to international scrutiny and were deluged by media, who, again, when they talked to the witnesses, it was so detailed. Their reports were so detailed and so heartfelt. They, too, wondered, my goodness, why isn't there an investigation? Why isn't there an explanation? And then suddenly, a month later, the flare theory came out that some people might have seen flares. Well, some people might have seen flares. I wouldn't doubt that the military was doing something to divert people's attention away from the true unknowns, but that's not what we saw, and that's not what we photographed.
Why else would they drop flares at, what was it, 17,000 feet?
Yeah, I mean, it was, and that's what I've tried to do in the years since, is educate the community to know that not only did something miraculous happen here, and look at the facts. The facts speak for themselves. But the other thing is what happened to people at a very, very deep soul level. I mean, 6 months before the mass sighting, the movie Independence Day came out. And so children who were the first witnesses to see these things and alerted their parents to it were frightened. We're so ingrained with it's a threat and we should be frightened. And they were frightened because that's the mindset after the Independence Day movie. Some of them were jumping up and down, Independence Day, Independence Day. But as it got closer, what's really intriguing is that not only children but adults as well felt a connection to the phenomena, felt an awe, a wonder. It was just so mind-boggling to see something so massive, a mile to 2 mile wide phenomena, glide right over their heads. I mean, this is very low. We had witnesses that said they could have thrown a stone at it. It was so low. To have the witnesses afterwards realize that how lucky they were. I mean, I've had that said to me over and over again. And in the same sentence, somebody that didn't see it said, oh, I wish I would have seen it. There's a lot of people that are very open to this now in the area because, again, there was no harm or threat or abduction reported in 10 years. Now, there certainly were people out there that couldn't deal with it, that just ignored it, that denied it, and still to this day do, as well as people that forgot about it. They just totally forgot about it. As you said, they were told, don't worry about it. This isn't to harm you. And they actually forgot about it until they saw a TV show on it a month later. Remember, wow, we saw that. Remember that? And the whole family would then be awakened to their experience. And it's changed people's lives here. There have been a number of people that have moved here. A active Luke Air Force person who asked for a transfer a year after the mass sighting because he wanted to see these lights. He was so intrigued by the story. And he's been seeing them and photographing them, which is really neat.
I was going to ask, did he see them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, we have some of his footage in the documentary.
Oh.
Yeah, it's very cool. Very cool. And it's really changed the face of the media here as well. Now, I had done, being involved with medical communications, health communications for the community, I had done health reporting for NBC way back in 76 when Jessica Savage, I don't know if you know that name, but some people might, had a syndication. And when we moved here in 1980, started doing health tips for NBC here as well. This has been going on for a long time with communication and getting it out there. And I knew a lot of the media from that. And I stayed anonymous for 7 years. Jim Delatoso and Michael Tanner from Village Labs let my pictures out there. I shared my photograph, unique photographic collection, because the data, that's what's important, not
yes.
me. It's the data that's important.
Exactly.
And they named me Dr. X. This came from Dr. X for all those years. And the media that I had worked with had no idea who Dr. X was. And when I did come forward, these wonderful, wonderful producers and directors and that I had worked with in the early 80s really came to the plate. I mean, they knew that I wouldn't be doing this if I hadn't done my homework, and they respected what I had done in the past, and they've really opened their arms. I mean, I am constantly running to because of the 10th anniversary, for interviews for every news station here. The snickering and the criticism and the ridicule that I was so frightened of has really dissipated here. They're much more open to talk about these things and to put them on the air and really do a credible job.
In the few moments we have left together, Dr. Lin, you are an educator, and you were talking about the kids' exhibit that you've put together. Are you intending to do any more for kids?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. My main focus all along was to get this into schools. I mean, that has been my life's passion for 30 years, is curriculum for the classroom. Unfortunately, even though I was invited to one school, and this really did it to me. Actually, this was a sign to me personally that I needed to make the documentary, because I had been approached by a filmmaker after the book came out and was a success, and he was very well informed, and his parents lived here, and He was very persistent, and I had gone back to work. I had gone back as chief clinical consultant of the Arizona Heart Institute Wellness and Imaging Center to help put our younger son through medical school. He's now a neurology resident. Yeah. I didn't have time. I mean, I was working full-time, doing radio programs like this into the night, doing Barnes & Noble and Borders presentations for the book on the weekends. And, you know, frankly, I just didn't have the time. And he was very persistent. And then I was invited. Parents had seen me at Barnes & Noble and invited me to a middle school here. The last period of the day, there were 200 middle school students on the edge of their seats. I mean, they thirst for this knowledge. They just couldn't get enough of it, and it really made me realize that there is a chunk of history missing from our history books. And I hope with the book and now with the documentary, and that really prompted me to do the documentary, certainly I want to get it into schools. That may take some time because it is still a controversial topic.
Yes.
Now opening up their arms to say, hey, something's going on here. We want to learn about it. And this has just been so, so rewarding, and I'm overwhelmed with the reception, and my hope is certainly to get this into the classroom. And because I have a 2-year-old granddaughter now, I also have started to write a book series on this topic from 2 years old. On with Dr. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona. So we're just getting that, just starting to get that together, and that's my next big project is really to embrace this for younger children.
And train the minds of future investigators into this phenomenon, because I have a feeling we're not going to find out about it while I'm around anyway.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, I think that things are happening at a very fast pace now. There's definitely something going on, and when you look at the message that's happening worldwide, not only to wake us up to their presence, to whoever is visiting us in a gentle way, but also to what we're doing to ourselves and our planet before it's too late. So something is accelerating here, and something is waking a lot of people up, one person at a time. And I hope with the book and the documentary that I can help in that behalf. And certainly when I did present at the school, I realized quite quickly that there is a chunk of history missing from our history books, and with the Phoenix Lights, the Skeptics discovery that we are not alone, and the documentary, I hope I can help fill that gap a little bit. And I haven't looked back, Earl. I mean, it's just been an incredible, incredible adventure for me too, because I knew nothing about this, and here I am educating others on it. So it's amazing what has transpired, and you know, if I can lend a credible voice so that people actually look at the data, then so be it. And that was one of the main reasons that I came forward, so it wouldn't just sit on a shelf.
Dr. Lynn Kitai, I trust that it will not be the 20th anniversary, and we are still here talking about them and scratching our heads. I want to thank you for joining us today, and the best of luck with
the
projects.
We can't do this alone, Earl. This is a team effort, and you know, you included. I mean, just getting the information out there, making people aware, raising awareness, raising consciousness to the reality of these phenomena, and to just look and listen is such a wonderful contribution to all of this. Thank you.
It's my pleasure, and it's my assignment whether I choose to accept it or not.
I hear you. I hear you. Well, you take care now.
And you too.
Thank you. Okay. And I love to hear from the listeners as well if they want to email me through my website, thephoenixlights.net. It's a joy to talk with you, Earl.
We'll talk again soon, I trust.
I hope so.
Okay.
I hope so. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye now. Dr. Lynn Kitai, and the website, once again, thephoenixlights.net. Go check it out. A wonderful disc, a fascinating book, and an amazing woman. An amazing woman. And when she talks about credibility, who could be more credible than her? She worked for NBC when she was younger. She has been putting out educational videos for years. She's a full-blown MD, and here she is working among us. And the more people like Dr. Lynn Kitai, the better off we're going to be. miss out on this special edition of Strange Days Indeed, the strange things that happened around Phoenix, Arizona 10 years ago, March 13th. Let's head down to Alabama. And I'm going to mention the town this time because Enterprise, Alabama, is where Alfred Lemberg lives. And they got whopped pretty bad by a tornado a week or so ago.
How you doing? And been cleaning up ever since.
Yes, and I understand that you've been a damn fine neighbor and helping people.
Well, I mean, how can you not?
Well, yeah.
You know, I mean, if you don't help, they'll come and get you later and hang you in effigy. So, you you have to get along. You have to be a citizen, or your neighbors will get you.
Through the benefit of modern technology and the way people are listening to us now, you've been able to listen to the voices on this week's program. What do you think?
Well, I think across the board, discussing Chris Rolfe, discussing Dave Furlott, discussing Mr. Fortson, Mike Fortson, and Dr. Lynn Katai, all considered, all told, I think it was a seamless symphony of sincerity and honest agreement of purpose. I was just so gratified and honored to be a small part of it. I think this is an auspicious beginning for this new format of program.
I love the people in this program. They all, as you say, they're all genuine. You hear it in Mike Fortson's voice. Lynn Katai is as enthusiastic sounding now as she was when she was on the program a couple of years ago. It's really amazing. And the way that they have worked, and Mike Fortson very quietly, because as he said, he's not a researcher. He's just a guy who happened to see something and got totally fascinated by it and blown away and has hunted down many other people who saw the same things and different things, too.
Well, Mr. Fortson was speaking in terms of hundreds, and Dr. Lynn Katai is speaking in terms of thousands. I think there were a significant number of witnesses that will come forward as time goes on, and should come forward, and I encourage them to come forward. Because the closer we get to the end of this thing, I think the better off we're going to be.
I'm not holding my breath, and I've said that many times, you know.
Well, I am, on the other hand. So I'm a little concerned that people kind of get on a stick here and kind of, you know, help me get a breath of air, because I like to breathe.
And that, for some reason, doesn't surprise me, Alfred Lemberg.
Hey, why not? You know, people have dieted for UFOs. What was the expression? Dieting for... I forget what that was.
Oh, yes.
You know, back in the old days, going way back now.
That's... Yes, I mean, before the days of Strange Days Indeed. In the early days of the UFO updates list, there was someone who was dieting for disclosure.
That's what it was. That's what it was, dieting for disclosure. You know, and with all respect to her, too, because, okay, she was, you know, trying to do something proactive and good for her, but that dieting for disclosure was just too funny to pass up and walk away from. With regard to Chris Wolf, you know, he was talking about pilots, speaking about their interaction and contact with the UFO as it interacted with all three of them and they chased it around through the skies.
I need to correct you. That's two pilots.
No, I heard three in there. I thought it was two myself, but there was another one that they were talking to. I could have heard that wrong, but I'm certainly two anyway.
There was an older voice in there, wasn't there? A more mature voice.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that was ground or whether that was another pilot.
Yeah, perhaps it was ground. Perhaps it was ground. You know, I could have it all wrong. But the point being, they were very obviously pilots, and they spoke a pilot lingo, and they were obviously doing pilot things while they were talking, or this was one of the better hoaxes that were ever set up, I think.
And I played the clip for Don Ledger.
Well, what did Don say?
He said, well, they sound like pilots to me. In fact,
yeah.
He said that they're definitely pilots.
Yeah, they sounded authentic. They had the proper jargon. And I'm a pilot, and I was convinced of their authenticity. But the authenticity of these pilots, incidentally, kind of raises a little wrinkle. You remember earlier that Jim Oberg, the NASA spokesperson, was talking about pilots and their apparent reputation for being poor witnesses, poor observers.
Yes.
And which is complete and absolute ridiculousness. And I think that the banter between the pilots in this clip kind of belies that whole Oberg alleged incompetence at observation that pilots are supposed to have.
And when you hear those cool, calm, collected commercial airline pilots, as in the Black Box documentary that played in the States and up here in Canada a couple of months ago, and you hear those very calm voices describing what it is that they're seeing, objects whipping past their aircraft, flying across the nose of their aircraft, flying alongside them, these are not bad observers.
Right, and they're talking about it again in very precise language, very measured in three dimensions, and in no way credulous, in complete intelligence. You know, I mean, you'd bet your life on these guys. You know?
And you do every day you fly.
Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. So where Mr. Oberg is coming from, I have no idea.
I know exactly what he was doing, and what he was doing was he was using a poor example as an excuse. And the way that works is pilots in a situation concerning an aviation accident are not good witnesses to the accident. I mean, you don't get good testimony from them sometime in the fashion that you want to drag someone who doesn't know anything about the operation to come in and give their take on it. So they drag some sergeant out of the pup tent, and they say, "Hey, Sarge, what happened?" And the sergeant goes, "Well, it flew over there, and it hit that tree and crashed." So that's what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. A pilot, on the other hand, is going to go, "Well, as I witnessed it, it was probably at an angle of about 3 degrees and a full aileron left into a tuck of, you know," they want to hear it hit the tree. I guess because they want to make it easy for their collateral investigations.
The investigation board, yeah.
But that's kind of what he was doing. And so, again, he was doing what they all do, is use something that is a poor example as a distraction from what really might be going on.
Oh, that's like flares at 17,000 feet.
Well, you know, that's also something that's very interesting, too, because the point is, and Don Ledger has pointed this out, among other people have pointed this out,
and he'll doubtlessly point it out next week on this program.
My point being, I have some personal experience with the flares in question that are shot from rocket pods aboard aircraft. And Don Ledger, among others, has been very clear that there is absolutely no credible reason why those flares should be shot at 17,000 feet, because they would be a hazard to civil aviation. They drift down over airways because of the dollar loss incurred of just shooting these off willy-nilly for absolutely no reason at all, and that there is no safety hazard with the landing with these munitions later on. I have taken off and landed numerous times in much more hazardous aircraft with all manner of strange munitions and armaments aboard a AH-1 helicopter that is an attack helicopter, a fighter aircraft. So flares, if they did go off at that altitude, and I still don't think they did, if flares did go off at that altitude, they were only there to provide a distraction from something else.
There was not only one aircraft out there doing nighttime gunnery practice or bomb dropping, there were several. As Don Ledger pointed out on the UFO updates list today, Saturday, these guys all have night vision glasses now. Why do they need to drop flares? And again at 17,000 feet, but we'll leave that question dangling like a flare at 17,000 feet.
Let's move on to Furry, then.
Dave Furlott, yes.
He's talking about Greer and Paul Hellyer and the whole exopolitical thing, and I think I've got a pretty interesting take on that whole thing, and not interesting so much as amusing to me, all right?
Go ahead and amuse us all.
But one thing I want to get to first was Greer is producing a new video, and that kind of fomented this whole thing, and it apparently features Paul Hellyer?
I believe so. I've ignored them all. There are too many important things to do in my life concerning the work, and I'm damned if I'm going to go and waste my time with the exopolitics crowd. They're just a total and utter waste of time and a total and utter waste of talent.
Well, I think I'd have to agree with you on both points, but in kind of a unique way, I think. See, I think what we have here, this exopolitical thing, if you look at it from the standpoint, is that there is a group of people, and credible people, you know, people like Bassett, people like Victor Vigiani, and there are others.
Michael Sala.
And Paul Hellyer, for instance.
Yes.
And I think the attitude is, you know, like we have some people across the river, the insubstantial other, that we're going to have to address and acknowledge in some kind of capacity, and it may be that the political one is the only one we have. You know, it's the only one we have any experience with. Do you see where I'm coming from on this?
Yes, I do. And again, I have to say that I think it's a disaster that Paul Hellyer was given Philip Corso's book to read the day after Roswell.
Well, we've all got to kind of remember about that, too. It was Philip Corso that only whetted Hellyer's appetite. It was an American Army general, confirmed by two other people, that told him that Corso's probably more on the level than that, which I think really started him going.
Unless that's another deliberate disinfo campaign.
Well, you know, we have enough of those.
Well, we've got Canada's defense minister who's going to step up to bat for these UFO saucer heads. So let's feed him. Yeah, Corso was absolutely right. And let him go out and play with that.
Yeah.
And distract and confuse and obfuscate.
Yeah, I can't argue. Except that it's politics. And we love and hate the people involved with politics. And politics is pretty dodgy. This exopolitical thing is dodgier still. They are as dodgy as just regular politics is dodgy, right? Filled again with people that you love to hate and those people that you love and hate. Good people, bad people. You know, people like Bassett, Vigiani, and Weber and Sala have been genteel and if credulous. You know, they've been nice guys about
yes.
the whole thing.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And the point is that there's a sincerity there and the same kind of guilelessness and the same kind of intelligence and that greater humility that we seem to have, and these people are being brave to a degree, you know?
Yes, except that you and I have open minds, but not so open, as the cliche goes, that our brains fall out.
Yeah, well, it does get inconvenient when you start kicking them around with your boots in front of you.
It's wonderful entertainment for a certain spectrum of the public, because it sort of falls between the Richard Halls and the Stanton T. Friedmans and the Jerome Clarks and the Alfred Lembergs and the rest of the gang at UFO Updates.
Yeah.
And the crazies
yeah.
who are out in left field.
Except for the fact that they have the attention of a large segment of the listening community, and they've got to be given some credence for that, right, wrong, or indifferent, huh?
Well, there are a lot of crazy people. Look at Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh. They got an audience, too. But that doesn't make them right or indicate that they're on the right path. Well, maybe the extreme right path.
Yeah, I think you beat me down pretty effectively on this. And again, something that was brought up by every individual who spoke on tonight's program, and that was this cooperation that we're going to have to be involved with. Well, what did Lynn Cattai says? That we can't do this alone.
Yes.
That together we have to raise the consciousness of these people who are only trying to fill the knowledge void that is thrust upon them by a culture and a society that in no way respects them enough to tell them the truth. When Lynn Cattai was talking about the kids exhibiting this edge of the seat interest in what was going on, and when you put that together with the crap and the pap that they get from their schools with regard to social studies and history that is no way in respectful of the individual the way it was when I was a kid, for that matter, you know, whatever that's worth.
Yes.
But the edge of the seat intensity and interest that, well, man, I'm here to tell you that I taught for a little while. I used UFOs as a teaching vehicle to get student interest. And I'm telling you that kids are attuned to, you know, what's going on out there? And is it the same there as here? And UFOs are right at the cutting edge of it for me. I think that's why I'm involved.
I want to go back to what Lynn Katai said, and you brought up just moments ago, raising consciousness. But you have to raise consciousness without raising hackles.
Hard to do.
Very.
It's a tough sell, especially when people don't want to hear the ultimate message that you've got.
Yes.
Or that you think you'd like to have. Look at somebody like Michael Horn, who, you know, may be completely off the beam and off the wagon and completely irrelevant about what's really going on. But the gentleman still has a sincerity and an honor of purpose that has always kind of impressed me, whatever he's saying. And there are many parts of his overall complete message that are not entirely repellent, you know?
Michael Horn, who is the proselytizer for Billy Meier, the one-armed farmer who supposedly had many, many UFO sightings and made film and pictures of them.
Yeah.
Way back
when.
60 years
and it won't go away.
Yes.
Now, what's up with that?
I don't know. I don't know, but I'm going to see my doctor in the morning and ask.
You know, talking about Mike Fortson?
Yes.
I thought he was very measured and fair about his comments about Dr. Katai.
He was nice and gentle, and they had their differences, and they've gone their own ways, but they're still doing this.
And he was clear about what the differences were.
Too. Yes, but they're still doing the same work.
Yeah. He's more just sticking to the evening in question. I think it was March 13th. Was that the evening
March 13th, 1997.
Right. And he wants to stay there, and Dr. Lynn wants to move back and forth on that and take more of a, oh, gee, you know, what are these things? Let's involve our total humanities, our total persons, our emotions, our intellect. Let's really reach out to this and embrace it and see what it is. And I don't think he wants to go there.
No, well, she's the educator, and that's what she's been doing all her life.
Yeah.
The educator, communicator. And damn, she's good at it, too.
And, you know, that was something, too, about Dr. Lynn Katai, is you might get the impression that she maybe wasn't all that successful as a medical doctor and that she's kind of ripe for being a whack job to get involved and interested in UFOs. When the point is no, she's extremely successful, incredibly successful. And what did she say? That she felt obliged. She felt obliged to get involved with this thing, to put her career on the hold.
For 5 years, yes.
For 5 years, to go on this journey, to try to get to the bottom of this thing. The things that she was clear about tonight that I hadn't really heard before is that while these sightings are going on a vicinity there, March 13th or thereabout, before and after and since, there have been sightings in Nevada, New Mexico, California. She used the figure 10,000 witnesses of these things going in and on and around the town.
It's pretty damned astounding, isn't it?
It's incredibly astounding.
Well, you and I both know there are tens of thousands of sightings every year. Literally tens of thousands. It's going on all around us all the time. And as it I've said many times before, seemingly it's been going on for centuries, if not for millennia.
Well, I think that was something that Dr. Lynn was pretty clear about, too, is she brought up the historical aspect again and talking about those ancient cave walls in Pakistan.
Yes.
But I don't think you can ever go wrong noting the historical aspect to this thing, which has actually moved on into prehistory. With regard to these artifacts that you're seeing wrapped up and buried in stone and what have you, and written on cave walls, you know, pushed into old ink. It's just incredible stuff. You just can't go wrong, you know, talking about the history because it's all UFOs. It's riddled with UFOs.
Yes. And the damn things have been around for just ever.
Yeah.
I think we need to wrap it up, Alfred Lemberg.
Okie doke.
I want to thank you, as always, for being around and doing what you do. You make my job so much easier.
Wow. I don't know how or why, but I really appreciate the sentiment and the comment.
Well, because you're such a damn fine contributor to this program. You've been doing it for years now, and you are so good at it. You have a really interesting pair of eyes there.
Well, I appreciate that, Errol. I'm flabbergasted.
Well, your flabber shouldn't be gasted. Not at your age. It can be dangerous.
Okay, hey, listen to this, man. I wanted to caution you to back away from your cans, but I want to make the bridge. Pay attention now.
Oh, my God, an Alabama fog whistle.
we made the bridge now. Now it's official.
Now that's really nice. Thank you, thank you. Been a long time since I've heard that. I appreciate hearing it again.
You'd never figure something so irritating would be, oh, gee, I've kind of missed that.
Thank you, Alfred.
Hey, enjoyed it, buddy.
Wish you'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Looking forward to it.
Bye-bye.
Absolutely, stop in here.
And that does it for this first podcast version of Strange Days Indeed. We trust you've enjoyed it, and thank you for subscribing once again. We shall talk to you next week. Have a wonderful week. Eyes to the skies, and au revoir.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to SDI@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.